Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on this snowy and starting to rain Friday. I'm Andy Klein, inviting you to join us today. And coming up today, we've got a really great show. Adventures in cartography, why there's more to making maps than just X marks the spot. And what's your source of information for the city and borough of Juno? Why the CBJ would like to know more about that. We're also going to be hearing about the art of Doralyn Alper, the February's featured artist at the Juno Artist Gallery, how her work reflects her healing approach to art. That's some of the conversation coming your way on this Friday's Juno Afternoon. Thanks for joining us. Well, I mentioned the weather coming up, and the weather forecast is a complex weather pattern over our area right now. That's according to NOAA. And currently there's a gale force wet front moving through the panhandle, bringing moderate to heavy precipitation to many areas and gusty winds in the southern panhandle. And then what's complicating this scenario is the Arctic cold air boundary that's been lurking just south of Juneau and Icy Strait all night. But tonight the warmer air should gain the upper hand, and that's going to mean rain. So for tonight, widespread rain showers, snow level going up to 1,400 feet this evening and lows in the mid-30s, southeast winds up to 15 miles an hour. Then rain in the forecast for tomorrow and tomorrow night, heavy at times, especially in the afternoon, highs in the lower 40s and southeast winds getting up to 25 miles an hour. Rain again tomorrow night, heavy at times. And then rain is in the forecast for the foreseeable future. Let's not say much more about it other than just rain. Highs in lower 40s, lows in the mid-30s, and some gusty winds, especially this weekend, happening. That's what's happening coming up in the weather. KTOO would like to acknowledge that we broadcast from the homelands of the Occoquan. The Kliné Di have stewarded this area for thousands of years. Today, our studios sit on a spot once part of the tidelands, now covered over with buildings, roads, and parking lots. We recognize those families who traveled to and from these tidelands to fishing and hunting grounds and to gatherings in other villages and still cherish it as an important part of their way of life for today and for future generations.
Hansen Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, where Kashuk are ye tin. Jin kat ka ke jin ta khana khaya ha an ka gun chish.
Sounds wild.
Hi, I'm Riley Woodford for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
In a glacial fjord in southeast Alaska, a group of sea otters has gathered in a big kelp bed. Some have draped kelp blades across their bodies so they won't drift away as they doze in the spring sunshine. Otters are good for kelp in a roundabout way, and this kelp bed is far larger than it was 20 years ago. Here's why. Sea otters are relatively new here, although they were a part of this ecosystem for thousands of years after the glaciers that carved these fjords retreated. They were harvested in small numbers for their fur by native Alaskans, but in the 1800s, Russian and British fur traders wiped them out. Sea otters eat sea urchins, and in the absence of sea urchins thrived. And sea urchins eat kelp. In the early 1970s, a few hundred sea otters from a surviving Aleutian Island population were reintroduced to southeast Alaska. With abundant prey, the sea otters thrived, and they've grown to number in the tens of thousands. Feeding heavily on sea urchins, the kelp beds have noticeably expanded. Fishermen harvest close to 80,000 blades of Macrocystis kelp in the spring in southeast Alaska for the herring roe on kelp fishery. And they've noticed the increase. The kelp beds are just huge now because of the sea otters. There's no shortage of kelp, one fisherman said. Sounds wild. I'm Riley Woodford.
COVID-19 at-home test kits are becoming more widely available throughout the community. These are great to use if you feel sick with any new symptoms. If you test positive on a home test kit, stay home and away from others for at least 5 days, and longer if symptoms persist. Inform your close contacts so they can monitor their own health. If you're at high risk for serious illness, contact your healthcare provider for guidance. Take care of yourself, and we hope you feel better soon. This message sponsored by the CBJ.
Well, thanks for being with us here today. You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. Apps, facts, and a lot of maps. That's the title of tonight's Fireside Lecture Series. It's being billed as an adventure in cartography. Typically, these Fireside Lectures are held at the Mendenhall Visitors Center, but tonight's going to be virtual, and we'll tell you about how to watch that in just a little bit. But first, let's meet our guests, Jackie Foss and Kelsey Aho. They're known as data geographers, and they have a passion for making maps and other visual guides to help outdoors lovers explore the Chugach and the Tongass National Forest. So, Jackie and Kelsey, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, you bet.
Let me just get where are both of you are. Kelsey, where are you?
I'm here in Juneau.
Okay, and Jackie, you're in Sitka, as I understand.
Yep, I'm in Sitka. So we're already virtual. We're well practiced.
I was going to say that's one of the small benefits of doing these things and getting used to doing things virtually. We can tie in from lots of different areas. So just tell me a little bit about, start with you, Jackie, maybe, since I've got you there on the screen. Tell me a little bit about what you're going to be going over and why these apps, facts, and lots of maps, how all those things kind of interact.
I am very excited to share this information. Kelsey and I like to think about our maps as a storytelling tool. It's a way of describing where we are by place. And so we use a lot of what we call geospatial data, which is just information that's tied to a specific place, a lot long, an island, anything else. And so increasingly we're visual people using our phones to navigate places, and the amount of data that's just available it's growing daily with satellites and, you know, people getting out and taking observations. So making that accessible and attractive is really kind of where Kelsey and I can help people, because there's so much out there. But the cool thing is there's people like us who have made sort of portals into these like geospatial data worlds that Kelsey has done just an outstanding job of finding a bunch of fun maps and apps and information to share.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's an interesting world that you both live in, because we have become so used to just being able to use GIS data like every day. Google Earth is on my phone and I can just zoom into whatever. It's a crazy leap from just 10 years, 20 years ago to be able to think about that now. It's incredible. So, but what is interesting to me is that even though I have this incredibly sophisticated tool compared to something 10, 20 years ago in my pocket, the way that data can be segmented and bisected and looked at in different ways is completely beyond me. So is that part of, Kelsey, I'll turn to you, is that part of what you all are going to go through tonight and talking about?
You know, we are. And we're actually going to start this evening by building a really simple app with everyone that joins. So we'll show how you can drop a few points into a map and how we can gauge information in real time, something like when you think of a dashboard of current events, whether you're up north and you're thinking about fire, or down here, you might have a dashboard of weather. I mean, for us, maps, they're both tools, but they're also like an aesthetic to them when it comes to storytelling. And of course, we have static maps that are paper maps that have a lot of value. And then we also have these dynamic maps like you're referring to, or something that's even an application that's on a phone, or that you're utilizing on a computer, or something that might even have a function where you can run some sort of analysis and find the fastest route, which is incredibly sophisticated.
Yeah, it really interesting. What are some of the other ways that people might not think about how to use a map, but helps them understand both these hugely complex ecosystems that you work in?
Well, you went through the weather forecast. I mean, Alaskans are so used to incredibly complex data systems, and it's all map-based. When you look at your, you know, zone area forecast, those are rasters. So the weather service models data according to these little squares. And so they average the different information between each of those stairs. So when you click on a pixel at your favorite fishing spot where you go and, you know, drop in on halibut, that is using a lot of the data systems that we have in the past. When you when your partner trolls and they're out on the fair weather grounds and you see the huge piece of ocean that they're predicting weather on, you're using this type of information. It's just, we don't think of it that way because it's just the weather, right? And we just check on that. But we, just by our lifestyle here, we're using a lot of this stuff already.
Sometimes it's, it makes me think that you both must look at maps the way Neo looks at the Matrix, right? It's just a bunch of numbers just streaming by. You know, in some ways, it's all these data points, and we don't think about that. When we look at a map, we think it's a visual picture. But really, all the maps that we deal with are drawn from zeros and ones.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I mean, I guess what you're describing, you're actually starting us at the very beginning, right? That's where the map starts, is on that first point that's put on that map. And because there's a lot of efforts out there where the public's engaged as well. There's an application called iNaturalist that you may have used, and the Forest Service, people can report data and you can have data that can be confirmed by either, if you're looking at bugs, we have entomologists or biologists that are out in the field and then can confirm what you're seeing. So in the Chugach, for example, folks have been going out there and mapping where they're finding morels after forest fire. And so those all just start with a single point. And then after we have this greater understanding, we can start creating like land cover maps or understanding vegetation trends across a huge landscape. But yeah, it starts with that one point, that yeah. 1, 0, or 1, presence or absence.
So interesting. There must be, is there a field of study that you're in right now that feels like, okay, this is the dynamic place, this is one of the dynamic things that's happening in our world of maps right now?
I mean, go ahead, Kelsey.
Oh, well, I mean, so, okay, I'll let Jackie answer what is dynamic. What I think is cool is that I think it's more accessible. You know, it used to be that applications, Jackie and I have been on the, you know, edges of our days or on the margins coding and learning different coding languages, but there's no like drag and drop options. People can dive into and build their own applications. And this really changes the game on who can run analysis and how different kinds of data need to be utilized, which is why it can be a little bit cumbersome if you're going through the Forest Service webpage and you're looking for different kinds of data, because we have it organized for all different types of users, people that want raw data or people that want data already in maps or in applications.
Yeah, well, that's what I was gonna say, Kelsey. I was gonna say that the data is all there, but how people interact with it is becoming a lot more straightforward. So you don't have to be Neo in the Matrix looking at ones and zeros. You can be on the outside saying, I really want to build a system of tree data, but I don't want to go that deep. I just want to pull the tree data in one place and be able to view it in relation to streams. And so it creates the ability for people to not have to be a computer scientist or a programmer. They're a cartographer, or they are a wildlife biologist, or they're a landscape ecologist that are interested in exploring data because they have some questions. So it helps folks that have the spatial knowledge, but not necessarily the coding background for it. And that's a pretty exciting place to be for more doors and accessibility for more people creating what they want.
It seems like it can touch upon so many different sciences, especially in fields of study, but also on just regular people's lives. How does that seems like a place where you guys want to really get to with what you're talking about tonight. So how does a normal person interact with maps in a way that they may not understand or may not anticipate?
That's a great question. Let's see.
And I think it also starts with like, what kind of map are you excited about? You know, we're also, we kind of see ourselves as like the maps or data series of the world. So we're like, okay, just tell us what you're looking for. And then we can kind of co-create or get you on a path to find that kind of application or what sort of analysis you could be running.
One of the things I'm just like, I would think right off the bat when you think in the world of maps is climate change. Okay, when you, mm-hmm. you know, you have different data sets over time of climate change in a graphic and, you know, visual way, you're able to see the changes over time. And then different levels of science can look at that, but also just regular people can look at that and say, oh, how's the glacier changed over the past 20 years? Everyone has that picture, you know, from 20 years ago, that standing by the glacier, and it's, you know, it's shocking almost to see it. But seeing that over in this graphical sense on in maps must be something that is talked about all the time in your field.
It is. And so one thing that I find really exciting right now is this thing that is the concept of something like a raster stack. So when you think of a stack, think of it like a series of layers that have something different. So you have the Mendenhall Glacier, and it's where it's moved through time. And then we put on top of that temperature, right? And then we put on top of that rain versus snow. And because you have all of this data together, you can see how this area right here, the Mendenhall Glacier, the temperature has changed this way in these areas and this way in these areas. And we can see, oh, this went from mostly snow driven to this is rain driven now. And that also, and so the glacier looks like this here. So when you think of data as not a single piece of data, but how it can interact with all of the other data out there. And this is just an example off the top of my head. There's so many people with broad knowledge that as soon as you consider the relationship between all of this stuff, and the fact that you can see it in front of you in a map, and you can move it around and you can make it different colors. And I, back to what you were saying, people might not realize that they're interacting with a map, because there's been some pretty amazing cartographers that have made the maps beautiful and accessible and useful in ways that people aren't even realizing that they're interacting, because it's just so seamless in the way they go through their lives. So signs that direct cruise ship passengers where to go, right? Like, that is a real thoughtful exercise, and that could be considered a map. Its place, its signs, but its purpose is to know where people are, where people want to go, and how to keep them from getting run over by a truck. So, you know, it's really important, like, how all of these different data sets relate to each other.
Oh, yeah. And I was going to say, and all the different disciplines that can play into that kind of question, such as how is the climate changing? I mean, Jackie and I joke about this. My mom will ask, like, oh, isn't everything already mapped? But a lot of these maps are dynamic. So something like the glacier, you know, we have like velocity of how fast the glacier is moving, because we have satellites that are taking images, you know, every 7 or 9 days. And similarly, we have data for volume. So we can use radar to see how is the glacier changing, like the height of it changing. So, you know, changes in volume, not just where it's covering the ground. Or, you know, you might have a, you know, veg ecologist that's using satellite imagery to see how different succession is changing alongside a glacier, which would be all different proxies for looking at climate and how it's changing through different disciplines.
I can't believe your mom is questioning this discipline of all people. Come on, mom.
She has to test me.
This
Come
is important
on,
work. No, everything's not math. Well, it's just like mothers everywhere. They, you know. But you know, that's such an interesting thing to think about, isn't it? Of course, the data points on a map, not only with a glacier that's obviously, you know, going to be, you know, receding or coming forward or whatever, but also in other areas, new data points. What are some of those kind of deep layers of data that still do need to be collected, or that you'd like to see collected in areas that we might think are fully mapped, or that, oh boy, all the data's already been collected?
Oh man, the state of Alaska. There's so many opportunities for mapping in the state of Alaska. So soil mapping is a product created by the NRCS that helps landowners know how best to use and manage their land. Currently in the United States, there's 400 million unmapped acres. There are 300 million of that are in Alaska, and this is considered baseline soil, thank you, Kelsey, soil data. So this is soil data that just says who's there, what is my substrate for my grow, that where what's growing there. And then you add wetlands, and then you add vegetation. So like basic ecological knowledge is missing in some of our remote areas of our like massive state, but also throughout the world, you know, just understanding where all these places are and being able to document those is not complete, because a lot of it's inaccessible, which is cool because there's so much opportunity out there for those who are interested in getting out there.
Still so much work to be done.
There's still a frontier, man. It's just not how people think of it.
That's a fascinating way to think of it. That's a fascinating way. We'll leave it at that. There's still a frontier out there. We can learn more about it from Jackie Foss and Kelsey Aho, who are going to be doing the fireside lecture tonight. So thanks to both of you for being here. Much appreciated. I want to keep talking to you about this, but we have to keep going here. So thanks for being here, giving us a full appreciation of this world of maps. You can watch their presentation tonight at 7 o'clock. It's online. All you have to do is go to the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center Facebook page, and you can find it right there. So go there at 7 o'clock tonight. Is there going to be an interactive component to that? Will people be able to kind of – how will that work?
Yeah, we will have an application where folks will – we'll have like a survey component, and you'll be able to see the data you put into it in real time. So we'll compare some favorite seasons and places on the Tongass and the Chugach.
That's great. All right.
Yeah, we're going to try to crowdsource with the chat, so as best we can.
Yeah, it's we're still the Zoom world is still developing as well, but a fascinating thing and an exciting presentation happening. Again, it's at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center's Facebook page, and if you go there at 7 o'clock tonight, you can hear from Jackie Foss and Kelsey Aho on the fascinating world of maps. Thank you so much to both of you for coming in for coming into your living rooms there and talking to us about your presentation tonight, and good luck with that tonight.
Thanks.
And up next, why the city and borough of Juneau is reaching out to find out the best way to reach out. That's coming up next.
Support for Juneau Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juneau with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juneau. More at heritagecoffee.com.
Trapping season has arrived. Trapping is popular and legal in most of Alaska throughout much of the winter and spring. Pets off-leash can get caught in traps. Maintaining physical control of your pet is the best way to keep them safe. Trappers, be mindful of other trail users. Avoid setting traps along or near popular trails and mark trap lines clearly. Follow the Code of Ethics on the back of the Alaska Trapping Regulations. Sponsored by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game and Alaska Trappers Association.
This is Bird Note. Rodney Stotts decided to become a falconer after years of working with injured raptors and teaching young people about wildlife. There's a long process of training and licensing involved in becoming a falconer. An additional hurdle? He didn't see anyone like him doing it.
And then people looked at me, and I guess it was funny to them because black falconer just didn't go together. And then once I got my foot in the door, that was it. So you couldn't slam the door anymore.
Rodney eventually found a mentor and began training and handling birds of prey. Now a certified master falconer himself, he introduces kids from the Washington, D.C. area and beyond to the majesty of raptors.
First of all, just to see them smile, I pull this bird out and their eyes light up and the excitement in them, that to me is a blessing. Because whatever you were going through, for that split second, you felt better.
He hopes his programs help students imagine more possibilities for themselves.
To have somebody, when I was in the fourth grade or fifth grade or something, to come in and bring a bird and tell me that I can do these things may have changed the whole course of my life. Who knows?
Learn more in Rodney's new book with Kate Pipkin, Bird Brother, A Falconer's Journey and the Healing Power of Wildlife. Find a link on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Remmel.
This is Juneau Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. For the city and borough of Juneau, the ability to get information out quickly to the community became a life and death matter during the pandemic, and it used as many ways as possible to get the word out, and I'm sure that many of us got lots of different channels of information from the CBJ, especially at the beginning of the pandemic. Now the CBJ wants to find out what's the most effective way to communicate with you. And joining us now to talk about that is Robert Barr. He's the deputy manager for the CBJ. Robert, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Andy. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you. And this is, I think, a really fascinating thing that the CBJ is getting back to us about. Okay, well, here we are putting out all this information. How is it reaching you? What's the best way of it reaching you? And tell me more about the conversation there you want to have with the public.
Yeah, you kind of hit the nail on the head. We really did a lot during the course of the pandemic. Our staffing changed a whole number of times, kind of ebbed and flowed as we were working on different messaging strategies and, you know, getting information out about everything from, you know, case counts to how to get tested for COVID to therapeutics for COVID to vaccines and all of the efforts around that. We just realized that we'd kind of been running at a sprint for a really long time, and we wanted to take a step back and think about how well all of that had been going, or not well, as the case may be. And part of that is reaching out to the community through this survey and getting some feedback and getting folks to tell us how it went for you, and how it should go going forward. So we really want to know kind of how you get your information, how you want to get your information. We spend a lot of time dealing with social media right now, so there are some questions in there about whether that's a good thing, or maybe not so good of a thing, or all kinds of stuff.
What were some of the new channels that you were trying with the CBJ, or where'd you find the staff investing time in trying to communicate that were maybe new ways for the CBJ?
Well, we certainly engaged a lot more on social media than we have in the past. So, and by that I mean we've always pushed information on social media, but especially early and maybe in the middle course of the pandemic, we had staff that were actually spending their time, going back and forth within comment sections and things like that on social media, and really though, kind of the theme of pandemic communication for us was, Is there an information channel? Okay, if so, we're going to use it, right? It was more of a shotgun mm-hmm. approach than a surgical approach, because the goal really was as much as possible all the time, kind of full bore. And we know that's not sustainable, right? We don't want to, we hadn't been sustainable before the pandemic. And frankly, some of the ways that we had been funding that won't be around anymore after the pandemic. A lot of public messaging related to emergencies is funded by the Federal Emergency Management or Association, FEMA. So
now that, could you just back up on that 1 second? I kind of explain that a little bit. Did you staff up? Okay, so tell me about that. Are there positions that are there that are going to sunset? What's going to happen there?
So we did a couple of things. So we early in the pandemic, we reassigned staff from other departments to the Public Information Office. And we also staffed up, although the positions that we hired temporarily aren't with us anymore. So we've already sort of staffed down, and most, although not all, of the staff that we've reassigned from other departments are back in their original departments now. And staffing was one of the pieces of things that we increased. We also pretty dramatically increased the amount of money that we were spending on advertising through all forms of media, radio, paper, web, and that that funding stream, federally funded, is going to be ending here soon too. So
I just as a member of the public and a resident of CBJ, noticed that. I noticed it on my Pandora stream. Right, there was all of a sudden there was Pandora. You know, that seemed like, well, this is a new thing for CBJ, for my city government to be getting information out on Pandora or Spotify or those kinds of things. So that's an interesting thing that there's all these different channels to move into.
There are, and it's really hard to know which are the most effective for the public. So, yeah, it's nice to hear you say that you heard one of our ads on Pandora, because we never really know. Like,
it also means I'm cheap and don't pay for my Pandora. But it is in a way that there's another thing that's going to be interesting. I think that will be an interesting part of the survey will be if people recognize which channel they were on when they saw the message. Yeah. You know, that's going to be an interesting thing. We're on so many different sources of media during a typical day now that you sort of forget where you saw something or where you heard something.
Yeah, and you know, a big thing that we want to know is, is hearing and gleaning kind of CBJ related information just kind of as that information comes across your streams, whatever stream might mean for you, you know, Pandora or social media or whatever, like, is that the best way to do it? Or would people more prefer to be pushed information directly based on what they opt into, you know, that kind of thing? So there are lots of questions kind of asking, kind of trying to tease out that sort of thing.
Is part of the another piece of that asking about retention? That's another thing that I wonder, do you retain as much hearing something on a quick ad or reading it or seeing a mention on social media? I wonder about that as well.
Yeah, I don't know that we specifically asked that question in the survey, but there's definitely some open-ended spaces where people could talk to us about that. I mean, I remember, this is a really long time ago, but one of my classes in college was on marketing or advertising or something along that nature. One of the kind of factoids that stuck with me was that at one point the professor said something along the lines of, you know, when you're trying to convince someone to, you know, buy a new thing or engage with a new service, they need to hear your ad like some crazy number of times, like 9 times before they'll
seven.
Okay,
right, sure.
So, yeah.
Depends on which textbook you're reading, which marketing professor it is, right? But yeah, that's right. There's repetitive, that idea that a repetitive message is what you need before someone's, you know, really hears the message. Yeah.
Right.
So, tell me a little bit about how the survey, how that works. How long is it going to take for someone to take the survey? How will they find it? How will they see it? That kind of thing.
Yeah. So, you have a couple different options for how to take it. The easiest is probably go to juno.org/survey, and you can take it online if you have a good internet connection. It takes about 5 or 6 minutes. It's not too long. It's also available online in Spanish and Tagalog. So if English is not your first language, we have those other options for you as well. And we have paper copies available as well. So if you'd prefer to take the survey on paper, you can do that. Those paper versions are available at all 3 public libraries, as well as the City Hall cash office.
Is it
so juno.org/survey?
Is it an anonymous survey, or is it one where you have the option of leaving your name or contact further, or how does that work?
Yeah, it's optional. So it can certainly be anonymous, but we do we're providing 3 $100 Visa gift cards. So there's a drawing for those, just as a way to incentivize people to take the survey. And if you'd like to be entered into that drawing, then there's a box at the end of the survey where you can just leave your name and contact information in case you win.
And I'm sure part of that is about just wanting to know demographics, wanting to, drill down a little bit into the profile of what people are, you know, how old they are, that kind of thing, to figure out what's the most effective way to reach different audiences.
There's certainly a little bit of that in there.
Yeah. So, Robert, I want to get to your other hat, which is a related hat, but I don't want you to leave without getting a bit of an update on what's happening in COVID, in general, at least here in CBJ. So, you know, we've certainly heard so much about the Omicron spread that, you know, in the last week or so, we've been one of the peak states as far as per capita spread of that. But maybe it's peaking, maybe it's leveling off. Tell us what you know about that.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. So, you know, I think I'll talk about nationwide, statewide, and then local. So nationwide, certainly we are seeing Omicron start to decline pretty substantially in quite a few areas throughout the country. So that is good to see. Statewide, it looks like it's a little bit slower, and maybe we're seeing a plateau, but we're a little bit less certain about that. There's still quite a bit of spread happening throughout the state. When you look at things on a local level, we can definitely say with confidence at this point that we are starting to see a decline, although the speed, the rate of that decline is much slower than we thought it was going to be based on data that we had early out of South Africa and countries in Europe that had experienced Omicron before we did. So, you know, just to give some context there and some numbers, when we hit our peak with Omicron, we were around 100 or slightly more than 100 cases per day in Juneau. Once that peak ended, we trickled down to about 80 cases a day, and then a couple for about a week, and then a couple of days of 60 to 70 cases a day. And then as of today, for the past couple of days, we've been around 55 to 57 cases per day. So directionally, we're headed in the right direction, and we have been now for a couple of weeks, just slower than we had hoped.
And how do you think the proliferation of more home at-home testing, and also the ending of the testing that's happening, the public testing that's been happening at the airport, how will that figure into knowing what those cases per day numbers are and if they're accurate?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think I'd start with saying that we've known throughout the entire course of the pandemic that there have always been quite a few cases out there that we haven't known about. Asymptomatic spread has always been a thing, and then sort of lightly symptomatic case activity where people didn't seek testing has always been a thing. But you are absolutely right that with the rapid antigen at-home tests, those don't necessarily get captured. Although it is our experience that many people go seek a confirmatory PCR test, even though that isn't absolutely necessary. And when that happens, that case does get accounted for and reported. It's important to note that the number of cases per day that we report, looking at those data sets over a longer period of time gives us the ability to be more confident in those numbers. So any sort of one day spike or it's just more important to look at those from a week by week perspective to get a sense of where we're headed. I will note too that even though testing has ended at the airport, Capstone Clinic continues to provide testing in the community. So they have a drive-through location. The testing is still free. Your insurance information is collected, but no charges are passed on to you. They're currently operating out of the parking lot out at Alaska Industrial Hardware. And it's a great operation. So they continue to provide really great customer service. They do a good job. Their turnaround times are pretty quick, 2 to 3 days. So they're still out and about doing good work in the community.
And is that something that you can just drive up to, or do you need to call ahead of time to schedule an appointment, or how does that?
It is, yeah. So you can just drive up to Capstone. You don't need to call ahead. You don't need to schedule ahead of time. And if you have previously tested at the airport, they already have your information. It's the same system. So the registration process is really quick. And that's not the case for our operation. So you do need to call us ahead of time to schedule an appointment if you want to use the CBJ option out of the Fire Training Center. And the number for that is 586-6000, or you can register online at juneau.org/COVID.
Great information. One last thing on this. What's the CBJ advice right now on the best practices on avoiding catching this virus?
Yeah, so we still are at a community risk level that we call modified high, or level 3 modified. And that really just means that there is still quite a bit of community spread going on. There's quite a bit of COVID out there, and we are still seeing impacts to our hospital and public health system. Specifically, most of those impacts, they have shifted. So we're no longer seeing that many, you know, active, serious, severe cases in the hospital, although we do still see some. The impact is actually now more largely on staff being out sick. So Omicron has really, really hit us hard from that perspective. And we recognize that it's not only the medical system, the hospital that's impacted, other industries, other bits of critical infrastructure around town that we all rely on too are impacted by staff being out. So that's been a major impact of Omicron. So from a strategy perspective, we still very much recommend and currently still require masking when you're out and about in public. And the best mask is one that fits you well and you will wear reliably. And then, of course, get tested if you are feeling any symptoms or 5 days after a close contact exposure. And then last and what's certainly not least, right, the most important thing is get vaccinated if you haven't been vaccinated, and get boosted if you're due for that.
And one more time on the survey, let's just circle back to that. How do people get involved in letting CBJ know what's the most effective way to communicate with them?
Yeah, so please take a few minutes to go take that survey. You can do that at juno.org/survey or visit any of our public libraries or City Hall to get a paper copy of that survey and fill one out for us that way.
All right, well, thanks for being here with us to give us a heads up on the survey. It's going to be interesting, I think, maybe for all of us to find out what's the source of information people use the most. Robert Barr, Deputy Manager for the City and Borough of Juneau, thanks again for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Andy.
Okay. Up next, how art is medicine to Dora Lynn Alper. She's the featured artist this month at the Juneau Artist Gallery, and we'll be talking to her in just a minute. Welcome back to Juneau Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein. Coming up right after the show, a First Friday event at the Juneau Artist Gallery featuring the work of Dora Lynn Alper, who mixes therapy and art. You can see the influence in some of her pieces on display at the gallery. And Dora Lynn is here right now to talk to us about her exhibit, which features ravens, but definitely has a Valentine's theme, which seems appropriate this month. Dora Lynn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And tell me, you know, I was reading a little bit about your work and about some of your background. And one thing that really struck me was a quote that you had that said, "I'm at my best when I'm making art." Can you tell me, can you expand on that a little bit?
When I make art, I find myself getting into a flow state where I'm just present in the moment. I'm not worrying about the future, not worrying about the past. And it feels really great to make art and see the creativity and the ideas just come and blossom in front of me.
Well, I know
I really enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, I know you work in art therapy. Tell me a little bit about the work that you do in that area. And then we'll definitely talk about your artwork as well.
So in art therapy, people get to create images. And oftentimes the images can reveal to us maybe what's going on in our unconscious, possibly relating them to what's going on in the present moment in their real life. And it can make it a way for people to talk about things that they otherwise may not find words for.
Oh, I see. So, I mean, I'm guessing this doesn't happen every time, but sometimes you're actually asking people to create a piece of artwork that describes their inner feelings about a specific thing or a specific way they feel or an event or that kind of thing?
Yes, they can do that. Or sometimes we just start with an image that's kind of ambiguous, that might be something like a string painting or something that is abstract. And then when they look at it, possibly they noticed something in it, or maybe they noticed something about it. And oftentimes that can be a way to kind of relate to real life and what's going on in the themes that might be happening.
That's really fascinating that you are using often abstract work. So often people who will look at abstract art and go, what is that? That's nothing, you know. And I personally am a real fan of abstract art. I love it, and it makes me feel certain ways depending on what it is, and I really connect with that, and I like that a lot. But it's really fascinating to me that you feel like often abstract art can actually show and can express an emotion that, or can express a feeling or underlying thoughts that people maybe didn't even understand they had.
Yes, and that is often the case. You get that aha moment, and it's really kind of exciting because then you start to find words for what you're feeling or what you're experiencing, and then you can make some progress on addressing that.
Wow, that's really very cool. Well, let's talk about your artwork, there's a lot of ravens in your artwork. Tell me about the inspiration behind the ravens in your artwork.
Well, between sessions, sometimes I'll walk out on the Riverwalk Park, or what we know as Whale Park, and often those trees are there, those dead trees. And every time I walk out there, there's ravens on them.
Yeah, they put those up for eagles, I think, but it's like the ravens are the ones that took over those trees.
Yes. The eagles tend to go on the really tall light poles, I think. So the eagles go really tall on the light poles, and right. The ravens take the trees. So yeah, that was my inspiration for doing some art.
And so I read a little bit about the fact that you're using sort of, I think of it like the Matisse cutout sort of technique, right? You're using cutout fabrics and cutout paper maybe, or what's the medium that you're using on the artwork?
Well, it's all fabric. So I often cut out some ravens on black fabric, and then there's some leftover parts between the ravens where they kind of fit together. And that is what I fashioned my trees from. So it's a very interesting thing. It's the scraps, but yet those make the basis or the focal point of the art.
And then there's a Valentine theme here maybe a little bit as well. Is that right?
That is. I found some great fabric locally and looked at that and said, I'm going to make some Valentines out of that. So we have ravens and the fabric. And if you look at them, they tell a bit of a story because there's all kinds of different things going on within the fabric. And then how the ravens are relating to each other. So I thought it was a good Valentine's story to have two ravens. And there's also ones with one raven on it. And so just some ideas for maybe things that people might want to give out at Valentine's.
And is fabric is that sort of the place that you're working in the most, or that you have worked in, or how have you settled on that as the thing that you work with to express yourself?
I've just really been drawn to it for a long time. So fabric, sculpture, and all different kinds of ways of putting things together. So I like to figure things out. I did a lot of boot sculpture, so made some little extra tough boots out of fabric and made my own pattern. And that was kind of fun to do. So I like to kind of figure out things and create things and how can things be put together.
That sounds like the extra toughs, ravens, the trees on the walk. It sounds like local things are the things that are inspiring you right now.
They are.
Yeah. And so tell me a little bit about your involvement with the Juno Artist Gallery. Have you been there for a while now?
I've been there for several years. About a year after I came to Juno, I joined up with the Artist Gallery, the co-op. And it's a great place, all local art. And it's really nice working with other people. And you also get to meet a lot of the tourists and a lot of the locals that come down there. So we're always looking for new artists to join Juno Artist Gallery.
And so First Friday, is this one of your, have you done other First Friday shows, or tell me about that?
I have done one other First Friday show, and I did some encaustic, which is wax and resin, that I did before.
And
First Friday comes every Friday for us. I mean, once a month.
Every month, yes.
Yeah.
How have the crowds kind of been? Have they been increasing now that feels like we're maybe getting through the worst of the pandemic?
I think so. On First Friday in December, there was standing room only in the gallery. There were so many people in there, and neighbors were seeing each other and friends were seeing each other, and it was really, really fun. So I hope, despite the weather, that some people do venture outside, because it looks like we got a lot of great First Friday exhibits this month.
Yeah, we're hearing. That's right. We're hearing from lots of different galleries that they're doing the First Friday, and you're right. Let's hope that we can get back to that place that Juneau always is, such a fun place during First Friday. Especially, I think the winter First Fridays are the best anyway. It needs to be a little bit of snow on the ground for it to really feel like a good First Friday here in Juneau.
I agree.
Well, do you know, are there other artists that are also going to be exhibiting in the Juneau Artist Gallery tonight?
Yeah, we have about 13 other artists. So we're always all exhibiting at the gallery. We just have a First Friday wall. And one of us gets that wall at different times. We take turns with that. So it's my turn this month.
I gotcha.
So there's lots and lots of local art to see down there.
Okay, very cool. So the First Friday wall belongs to you this time. I wanted to just get back a little bit to your work as a therapist. How long have you been doing that, the art therapy work?
I've been doing that for more than 20 years.
And you have you kind of recently come to Juneau, or the last few years, I'm gathering from saying that you...
About 5 years. Right. I've been in Juneau about 5 years now.
And where were you before that?
I was in Virginia.
Okay. And so the art therapy, do you work with all ranges of age groups?
I do. I work with all people who want to come, families, young children, teens, adults. I'll work with each person.
And what are the techniques that you have to change up for our children especially? I'm wondering how that... Does that come easier for children, or do they have a little bit more of a block about expressing themselves? How do you find that?
Children spontaneously express themselves through art. I have a really big whiteboard in my office. It's about 7 feet across and about 5 feet tall. And kids will come and draw on that, as well as I have a huge amount of art supplies. But with kids, we also have a lot of play time in the art room too, because they like to move around and play.
Which is therapeutic, I would think, no matter what. Right?
Yes. Yes.
So maybe it's a little bit harder to draw adults out, and I could see adults not wanting to come out of their shell a little bit. We all have our own thoughts about whether we're a good artist or not, in quotes, and that kind of thing. So how do you get through that sometimes?
So that's where I focus on the abstract art, or what I call art for success. So we have paper marbling that we might do, where we're floating pigments on top of the water. You dip your paper in there and you pull it off and you get the exact print that you made. Sometimes we do scribble drawings. So start with a scribble and then turn it different ways and figure out what it is and add some lines to it. Or maybe some string drawings, where we dip a string in paint and pull it through folded paper and then open it up and you've got an image. So that could be a beginning of a conversation.
That just starts a person off thinking about creating, and then from there you try to explore a little bit more in depth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, we start with conversation and we talk about things, and lots of fun things come out.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating to think about. I think all of us enjoy art for our own reasons, or for, you know, to connect with an emotional experience, but thinking about it in terms of real therapy, really delving into something specific, or to improving a person's outlook or something like that. It's really interesting to think about that.
Mm-hmm. It's a great way to get quicker into what's going on than just verbal alone. Because if you have an image and you're talking about your image or you're doing something, it's so much easier to get into that than to telling someone you don't really know what is going on or your problems. So it makes it easier, I think.
Yeah. When you are looking at doing one of these First Friday shows, do you have a number of works that you have in mind as far as trying to get to a certain volume of work to show?
I do. Sometimes I really, really get inspired by something. And before I knew I was going to do this First Friday show, I was really, really inspired by those ravens. I've been working on ravens for a while. Something about ravens, they're black, but they're not all black because there's more colors in there.
The iridescent.
And so,
yeah, right.
Yes. Yeah. So I was been really drawn to that. And so I just started making some landscapes. And then I said, oh, I think I'm going to put those trees in there because I saw those scraps I have. And oh, and ravens will go on those trees. So it just kind of grew out of that. And I think they're kind of fun and the Valentines are fun. So I hope people come down and take a look at the work and maybe take a piece home.
Yeah, well, I'm sure they will. I'm sure they'll come and check it out. Well, Doralyn Alper, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thanks for making the artwork that it increases the amount of art that's here in our town, which is always a good thing. Always more room for more beautiful artwork in Juneau. And Doralyn's work is going to be at the Juneau Artist Gallery. She's the featured artist this month, and it all starts with the First Friday that's happening in minutes. I mean, you probably have to get down to the gallery, right? You're probably looking at your watch.
I do. I got to get down there. Yes.
All right, Doralyn. Well, thanks for taking time out from your busy week and from your busy First Friday to let us know about your work that you're doing. That's Doralyn Alper, and she's going to be at the Juneau Artist Gallery for this First Friday and for the rest of the month as well and for the rest of the year as well. Your work is shown there as well as 13 other artists. Doralyn, thank you again.
Thank you.
Okay.
Support for Juneau Afternoon is provided by Hanson Gress, Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, and Klingit & Haida Social Enterprises. For more information, visit ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon.
That's going to do it for Juneau Afternoon, broadcast from the Klingit Ani on KTOO at 104.3 FM. Thanks so much for joining me today. It's my first time back hosting in the hosting chair for a number of months, and it was really thank you for bearing with me as I get my bearings again. Juneau Afternoon is a production of the KTOO Arts and Culture team. It airs live at 3 o'clock Tuesday through Friday and repeats at 7 o'clock. And you can also listen online anytime at ktoo.org. I'm Andy Klein. I'm your host for today. Thanks for joining the conversation. Have a great weekend. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. And to listen to interviews, see links to anything we discussed, or to be on the show yourself, check out our website at ktoo.org/JunoAfternoon. Thanks once again for joining me today. Have a great weekend.